Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the October 2021 edition of Poet Radio. My name is Chris Funkhauser, host of the program. As many of you are probably aware, WGXC is presently amidst its fall pledge drive, in which we're seeking to obtain sustaining supporters who are willing to make a modest monthly donation so that we may keep this remarkable community radio station on the air and net waves. In order to do this, all you have to do is head on over to our website, wgxc.org, and press the donate button at the top of the page, which will guide you through the process. It's easy, and your support helps us meet the most basic operating costs. So I hope you can do this as you enjoy our ACE programming. As part of the station's pledge drive motif, all WGXC programmers have been asked to say a few words about our programs and what they are about. If you read the Poet Radio description on the WGXC website, the program is described as, quote, blending words and sounds, bringing to the airwaves live performances as well as field and studio recordings by writers the host has crossed paths with over the course of a quarter century, unquote. Over the past 60 years, give or take, recorded media has offered writers and literary producers the potential to connect more broadly with others using tools embraced by mass culture. In the mid-1980s, I was extremely fortunate to study with Allen Ginsberg and others at Naropa Institute in Colorado. And Ginsberg, who's been the subject of the show on a couple of occasions, including its inaugural edition 6 years ago this month, made a significant impression on me the first time I heard him lecture. Quite profoundly, he said, quote, "We must be observers, not outside looking outside or inside looking inside, but outside looking inside or inside looking outside," unquote. This perhaps offhand notion helped me sense conditions of literature in a way my university education had not. As a student, a poet, and professor who considers these outsides and insides through technology as well as writing, I absorb much from the exploration. I reciprocate or feed back into it through teaching, scholarship, and by preparing creative and documentary works, connecting with the concerns of the poets. Voicing thoughtful, crafted expression across the globe has been an ongoing area of inquiry. With every investigative turn comes more to grasp and consider, and using recordable media to absorb and transmit poetic language and communication became one of the ways I engaged as a writer from the beginning. I attend poetry readings whenever I can do so. At a certain point in the 1990s, I developed a genuine yearning to be able to hear some of these readings again. Being able to revisit a poet's work after its initial vocalization became a type of personal need. Hearing readings again, I could build a better sense of a poet's project and understand her or his intent. Having a recording also held the benefit of being able to share a poet's work with friends and others who could not be present at an event. My practice as an audio documentarian started because I enjoyed and learned from having recordings of the many fine occasions I was able to witness. These artifacts hold personal, cultural, and educational value. I purchased my first audio recorder, a simple handheld Sony cassette device, as I was studying at Naropa. I had plans to use it as a tool to compose on the tongue, as Ginsberg put it. Ginsberg, in a Naropa class I attended, described his successes and failures in using a recorder to quote-unquote write. Ultimately, I've not used the machinery in this way, but have since continuously used it to document events I attend. And for the past few years, I've been most fortunate to be involved with WGXC, which offers an outlet for me to share some of these recordings to a wider audience. This brings me to today's program, which features recordings I've made of Ed Sanders. Since WGXC is a community radio station, a major inclination of the program is to feature members of the local literary community and local events on the program, and Ed is one of the most prominent and important writers in the Hudson Valley. To recall some of his countless accomplishments, I'll quote some of his bio from a volume titled Disembodied Poetics, Annals of the Jack Kerouac School. Quote, Ed Sanders has a personal history that spans a dozen mini-careers, from classic scholar to mystic militant peace and love activist, from investigative reporter to rock and roll star, from bohemian publisher and bookstore entrepreneur to utopian environmentalist and consumer advocate. He has published fiction, poetry, and nonfiction, including The Family, a bestseller about the Charles Manson cult. Unquote. In addition to many other written and audio projects, he composed a remarkable volume called The Poetry and Life of Allen Ginsberg. In recent years, Sanders has published volumes titled A Book of Glyphs, which collects poems done in conjunction with drawings, as well as Broken Glory, The Final Years of Robert F. Kennedy. These collections you'll be hearing readings of later in the program. I was very fortunate to encounter Sanders at Naropa, and the obsessive poetic and cultural qualities his writing embraces, in addition to his musical work with the Fugs, made a lasting impression. From a different angle, I aspire to follow a trail he introduced to me. Sanders' July 1986 Naropa course was titled The Theory and Art of the Electronic Bard. He talked about an electronic bard system, the importance of ancient poetic rhythms, and introduced musical instruments he had invented, such as the talking tie and pulse lyre. His deep and diverse poetic explorations, media and musically centered approaches to the dispersal of poetic craft remain mused to me. Among his profound artistic and scholarly endeavors, Sanders offers an indispensable piece of writing titled Creativity and the Fully Developed Bard, which introduces the multi-decade research project and its implications for writing and poetry. Shaping his message as a poem, Sanders celebrates and outlines the ways, quote, a multi-decade research project can be a wondrous structure to strengthen your art, unquote. Sanders' system is designed to assist writers in cultivating deep knowledge on a subject. He encourages establishing a, quote, creativity zone in a field of two or more dimensions, unquote, and referencing Charles Olson's composition by field, creating and sequencing data clusters that include the use of fact strips in sculpting a creativity zone. Sanders' impetus is for the writer to collect facts and use them in tuning their work. While I certainly use collage techniques as a writer, the practical result and effect of Sanders' idea took a technological turn in my practice, involving gathering recordings of other artists' work and collecting them into publications or archives. Instead of taking and compiling notes on form or subject, I began making recordings of poets and constantly engaging with audio and other media network technology. One afternoon at Naropa, I was scheduled to meet with Ed to discuss poems I'd been writing. For some reason that I do not recall, I felt it was important to simply converse with Ed instead, had the good sense to make a recording of it, and Ed allowed me to do so. I've interviewed numerous poets over the years, but this was the first. So to start today's show, I'll transmit a segment of this personally momentous occasion for the first time ever. Not only was Ed tolerant of my youthful questions, he was also very modest and erudite in his responses. Listening back to the recording last week, it struck me that it's not very often one encounters someone who is both humble and visionary at the same time. So here's a segment of our dialogue from many years ago.
What do you think it does to perform pieces that were like, you know, archaic, ancient things and bring them to the modern day? What does that do?
Well, it from the point of view of eternity, there's been no time pass between Shakespeare and us, really. Mm-hmm. If you take from the point of view of absolute reality, or the point of view of hundreds of trillions of parsecs or light years, Shakespeare is virtually alive. I mean, so therefore, this sense that history and life changes. Life is not like clothing styles, you know, which change every half hour. But it, you know, there is. I feel a great continuity with the poets. If you, for instance, as a poet, if you consider all the poets of the world for the last five centuries, that they're really brothers and sisters. You know, it's very. It's like a family. And it's very close in time. I don't feel so far removed from all those people from prior mm-hmm. centuries.
That's what do you like? What are you trying to do as a mark for what someone hits 200 years down the line? Anything? Do you think like that at all?
Whether anybody pay attention to my life?
You know, you're writing your music. I mean, do you want someone to be doing the Sanders stomp? You know.
Oh.
Do you? I mean.
I don't really think like that. I assume I dare to be my own history in the sense I do. No thanks. I do leave behind an archives. I keep files and diaries and stuff of my life, assuming it may or may have some interest in the future to somebody, probably scholars of the era or other writers. But I really don't think like that. It's hard. It's difficult.
What do you expect, and what do you think people should do musically now? What do you expect? What do you think would be a good thing to do musically? Yeah.
Well,
musically, right?
There has to be in electronics the equivalent of the piano forte. That is, right around the time of Bach, they were creating this new type of piano that you could, of course, play very. It was a growth of the harpsichord, in that it enabled players to be infinitely more expressive. They were using pedals and, mm-hmm. and playing softly and large, and also enabled the concept of the concerto to arise, where the piano was an actually powerful instrument that could act in concert with other instruments. So what's going to happen now musically is the electronic equivalent of the piano forte. That is, there's going to arise a musical instrument sufficient for a new Beethoven, mm-hmm. and it will be an electronic instrument, and it will have obviously many, many aspects of the modern electronic recording studio and the modern electronic high-end synthesizer. But it will be something more. It will be like I envision it like a giant church organ, only instead of stops, it will be like 15 or 20,000 buttons and knobs and XY pads and pressure sensitive areas and theremin like devices where you approach these little knobs with your hand and the proximity of your fingers to these zones and tiny little surfaces will indicate parameters and programs and moods and sounds and whatever. Anyway, this will be a giant console, which I would call the supreme organ, and it will, or the supreme piano. But it'll be electronic. And it will be I would guess that the traditional black-white keyboard will go, mm-hmm. and in its place will come these keying surfaces, perhaps curved keying surfaces, to allow for different within the same musical pieces, different scale, different octaves, different senses of octaves. For instance, you could go within the same piece from a regular 12-note octave to a 31-note octave to a 43-note octave to a 17-note octave, all of those four octaves, some being microtonal, have great capabilities within them to supply different chords, but more harmonious chords in some regards than the ones that you usually get on the regular 12-tone mm-hmm. piano scale. So, in order to make a 41-note octave, you have to have much tinier keys, and I would guess they would have to be very differently arrayed so that your hand, in reaching out across this array, can actually make chords and octaves within the same microtonal scale. So anyway, it'll be a giant touch thing, where it will be real, and where parameters and I guess a feet will have to be involved. In other words, you'll have to use both hands, both feet, and perhaps a group of assistants. In fact, it may be a collaborative thing.
Do you think that it's going to take more than one person to run this?
Not necessarily, but it could. You may need a technical assistant, or you may need a...
So it's going to be really complicated, though.
Yes, and that's why it'll require Beethoven. If you have something... You see, in the modern music, in the music to come, the parameters of each sound will be determined by the will of the composer. So that involves making decisions or following so that, in other words, to bring the will of the creator into it, you know, for a certain spontaneity. I mean, you don't want to just push a button and have a robot machine create, create a work for you that you pre-program. We're talking about playing something. But also somebody composing something. The ability to have a giant console that's good looking, like a church organ, that you can use your touch to modify all these parameters instantly. Make these sounds of different layers of sounds of different chords and stuff instantly with the, you know, as you create it. It isn't there yet. You know, all the synthesizer systems are you know, still much too odious to use. But this will be an instant system, one that can be, it won't break down, the signal paths will be clear, the parameter choices will be almost infinite, the sounds will be of incredible variety, and it will be like a recording studio, a musical instrument, a composer's instrument, and a performance instrument. But mega. Built for Beethoven.
Any idea?
And out of Provo, Utah, or somewhere, will rise some guy with a giant forehead, photographic memory, and someone whose first electronic composition was done from his cradle. Or whose first electronic composition was done from her cradle, will rise up to astound the electronic age.
Ed Sanders recorded in Boulder, Colorado, July 1986, with yours truly. To continue, a few years later, I had the opportunity to pursue a graduate degree in Albany, studying postmodern poetics with Don Byrd, Pierre Joris, and others. Don and Pierre were peers and friends with Ed, and due to proximity, our pathways began to cross with some frequency. I did not record every event where I heard Ed read, but did manage to make a few recordings, including a superb DAT recording of a show where Ed performed on a bill with Bob Holman at SUNY Albany shortly after Allen Ginsberg passed away.
A giant hole has been torn in the fabric of my own existence. He called me. He was one of the lucky people that got some of his calls, and he thought he'd live another month. So he was looking forward to us visiting him in his beautiful loft. He talked to my wife a lot longer than I. They were very good friends. He was. He said to her that he had been writing furiously and finished a book. That as his father, who also died of liver cancer, it was not the painful kind, so he wasn't in pain. And he'd had a wonderful dream when he first went to the hospital that he woke up from in great joy that he had had a child. You know, when he, beginning in 1962 on, he always hungered to have a child. And that he'd had a child, and he was so blissed. And then that was the day he learned he got the bad news from the biopsy. Anyway, that he was a great genius. I know that by hanging out with him and listening to him for over 30 years. He was a genuine American genius that I'm sure. And 3 years ago or so, I gathered from American poets mainly verses for what's called the New Amazing Grace. And I have verses from Pete Seeger and P.D.Q. Bach and Robert Creeley and Robert Bly and Ann Waldman and Diane DePrima, William Burroughs even, many different, about 150. The best of which are often from like ministers in the Midwest or people, just regular folk who heard about it on the NPR. But the very best verses were sent in by Allen Ginsberg. So in honor of him, they're the same verses that Bob read so well. I'll try to do them in them. I dreamed I dwelled in a homeless place where I was
was lost alone. Folk looked right through me into space and passed with eyes of stone. Oh, homeless hand on many a street, accept this change from me. A friendly smile or word is sweet as fearless charity. Woe working man who hears the cry and cannot spare a dime, nor look into a homeless eye, afraid to give a time. So rich or poor, no gold to talk, a smile on your face. The homeless poor, where you may walk, receive amazing grace. I dreamed I dwelled in a homeless place where I was lost alone. Folk looked right through me into space and passed with eyes of stone.
Ed Sanders, tuning Amazing Grace on WGXC. As mentioned earlier in the program, Ed is well known for his work with a rock band called the Fugs. And on the occasion of Thule Kupferberg, his bandmate's 90th birthday, September 2013, the group got together to play an afternoon concert at the Sidewalk Cafe in Greenwich Village, which I attended with my daughters. And here's a short excerpt from that performance.
This is a song I wrote on the Second Avenue bus in 1966, inspired by a poem by Charles Olson. We drink or break open our veins, so little to know.
I want to know.
need to know. Into our eyes, hundreds of flashes cause us to feel the life in the sky. I want to know, I want to know.
Ed Sanders and the Fugs on WGXC. And moving along, since I moved to the Hudson Valley in 2014, my encounters with Ed became more frequent, as has my penchant for making recordings at events. The remainder of this edition of Poet Radio will feature excerpts from some of these events, starting with the 2018 celebration of his book about Robert Kennedy at the Kingston Artists Collective. The book is the result of 40 years worth of research on Kennedy's assassination, a prime example of what Ed calls investigative poetry. Quite frankly, it's an angering book to read as it exposes so many villainous entities, and it's a truly forceful literary accomplishment. Here's one of the highlights of that 2018 reading.
His final speech. After adjusting the microphones and a fairly lengthy list of those he thanked for their help, Kennedy spoke for approximately 10 minutes. Congratulating Don Drysdale for his sixth straight no-hit shutout. The winner of California's 178 delegates, relaxed and smiling, thanked his wife Ethel, Rosie Grier, Rafer Johnson, and thanked the great support of black voters and the support of unions. He congratulated McCarthy. He pointed out that the country wants to move in a different direction. We want to deal with our own problems within our country, and we want peace in Vietnam, to great applause. He was looking forward to a dialogue or a debate with Humphrey, quote, on what direction we want to go in, what we are going to do in the rural areas of our country, what we are going to do with those who still suffer within the United States from hunger, and whether we are going to continue the policies that have been so unsuccessful in Vietnam. Then he finished. What I think is quite clear, that we can work together in the last analysis. And that what has been going on within the United States over the period of the past 3 years, the divisions, the violence, the disenchantment with our society, the divisions, whether it's between blacks and whites, between the poor and the more affluent, or between age groups, or on the war in Vietnam, that we can start to work together. We are a great country, an unselfish country, a compassionate country, and I intend to make that my basis for running, to great applause. RFK flashed a brief V sign and then left the podium. The crowd chanted in a powerful rhythm, "We want Bobby, we want Bobby." Behind RFK was a curtain leading back to the ramp. And instead of going off to his right as he faced out, down the steps and down an enclosure, he was pulled off the back of the stage through a gold curtain by a voice that said, "This way, Mr. Kennedy." And the first rule was let yourself get peeled off from your guards. His bodyguards, Rafer Johnson, Rosie Grier, started to help clear a path to Kennedy, to his right as you face it, to his left as you face it, to his right as Kennedy is faced, for RFK and Ethel and the others down the steps. So all three of RFK's guards, including Bill Berry, started to clear a pathway, and Kennedy was dragged off the back. So it was hasty. There was just 2.5 minutes between the senator leaving the stage and the flow of screams, shouts, and consternation from the audience. RFK was escorted absolutely alone and unguarded through the curtain and down a ramp and down to the swinging doors alone, leading to the kitchen where he paused to shake a hand. There was a young woman named Lisa Orso, a high school student in San Diego, who was standing by the door to the pantry as RFK entered the pantry. Suddenly she was shoved from behind and a young man pushed in front of her. I thought it was going to be a waiter, but it looked like he was trying to get in there and shake the senator's hand. It was Siron Siron. She saw a flash from the gun. Lisa Orso also spotted another person, a blonde wearing a gray suit with a gun in his hand. It was not Siron Siron and not wearing a uniform. ACE RFK researcher Philip Melanson interviewed another witness who saw a guy with a dark wavy hair and a gray suit shoot his gun once or twice and run out of the pantry. He was seen with Siron earlier in the evening. As I said, Siron had been spotted by an ambassador waiter standing on a metal table with a woman wearing a polka dot dress. Polka dot and Siron were talking. Then Siron dismounted the table. But as he fired at RFK, Siron thought he was shooting at circular targets at a firing range. From Dr. Daniel Brown's hypnosis sessions with Siron. Quote, Mr. Siron was led to the kitchen by a woman after that same woman had received directions from an official. Mr. Siron did not go with the intent to shoot Senator Kennedy, but did respond to specific hypnotic cue given to him by that woman to enter, quote, range mode, unquote, during which Mr. Siron automatically and involuntarily responded with a flashback that he was shooting at circular targets. Siron to Dr. Brown, when he and Polka Dot arrive in the kitchen. I'm still sleepy, very sleepy. I was flirting with her. The place was darkish. We were the only ones in that area. I don't know where the hell it was. A deep place to get romantic with that girl. Then she sat up on the table facing with her back to the wall. Her thighs and legs are right there. I'm looking at her, trying to take her beauty in. I'm trying to figure out how to hit on her. That's all I can think about. I was fascinated with her looks. She was sitting, I was standing, she was busty. She never said much. It was very erotic. I was consumed by her. She was a seductress with an unspoken availability. Then Dr. Brown asked Siron what exactly he remembers after she tapped or pinched him. All of a sudden, Siron said, all of a sudden she's looking over my head toward an area. Then she taps or pinches me. It is startling. It was like a wake up. The contact with my body. This is too abnormal for people to pinch like that for no given reason. It was like when you're stuck with a pin or pinched, a very sharp pinch. I thought she did it with her fingernails, like a wake up. It snapped me out of my doldrum, yet I'm still sleepy. She points back over my head. She says, look, look, look. I turn around. I don't know what happened after that. She spun me around or turned my body around. She's directing my attention to the rear, way back. There are people coming back through the doors. I'm still puzzled about what she is directing me to. It doesn't seem relevant to me. She kept motioning toward the back. Then all of a sudden she gets more animated. She puts her arm on my shoulder. I think she had her hand on me. I'm not sure if it was her hand or somebody else's. I thought I was at the range more than I was actually shooting at any person. Three weapons drawn. Siron's, a guard named Thane Eugene Caesar, and a tall man in a suit. In the words of excellent researcher Philip Melanson, in addition to Siron's gun and that of security guard Caesar, Lisa Orso saw another one. She clearly recalled someone she assumed to be a security guard drawing the gun. But Lisa's, Urso's guard was not wearing the uniform. A second witness, whom we shall call Martha Raines, told the author, that's Philip Melanson, of seeing a man fire a gun in the pantry. He was 6'2" tall, Caucasian, with dark wavy hair and wearing a suit. When Raines had seen the man standing near Ciron earlier in the evening. According to Raines, the man fired a handgun of some sort. She recalled that the gunman was not composed, and he shot once or twice and then ran out of the pantry. And I recall, said Martha Raines, one of the shots was high and should have gone into the ceiling. I don't know what those people found when they did their ballistic tests. Then, a guy named Evan Freed was there, who was later a deputy LA city attorney, but he was a photographer covering the primary at the Ambassador Hotel. And he saw a second gun. Prior to the speech's conclusion, Freed went with his camera to the kitchen pantry. RFK entered the pantry after his speech, and Evan Freed said he was walking by his side. Freed, I saw the second man wearing darker clothing who had been in the pantry with Ciron during the speech, pointing a gun in an upward angle at the senator. Based on the sound I heard, I believe the first shot came from this man's gun. In the background, I could see Ciron firing a revolver held in his right hand. People were screaming and grabbing Ciron. So 13 witnesses that I found from FBI reports and other reports saw Ciron with a woman in a polka dot dress. And the second gunman was seen by 3 witnesses that I have recounted. And I go into it in pretty exhausting detail in my book. And Coroner Thomas Noguchi did a meticulous, extensive autopsy of Robert Kennedy. And he said that he was shot by 3 bullets from the back. Through his armpit, another bullet lodged in RFK's spinal column, and a 3rd bullet which killed him, penetrating RFK's skull just to the left of his right ear, and subsequently shattered. Based on Noguchi's analysis of powder burns behind RFK's ear, he was shot just an inch from Kennedy's right here.
Ed Sanders on WGXC. One of the amazing things I've always admired about Ed's work is that it's not just presented in prose or poetry, but also as music, as in this final section from the Kingston Reading in 2018.
Robert Kennedy, he fell down, he fell down by the ice machine, by the ice machine, with the rosary in his hand. He lay by the ice machine, by the ice machine. Oh, won't somebody please tell me why the guns only point to the left? It wounded the nation in countless ways. Wounded her history, the rest of her days. It wounded the future like Lincoln a mort, or Roosevelt sinking, and the A-bomb's retort. Tell me again why the guns usually point to the left, with gunpowder ballots and voting with knife heft. Never for peace, always for strife, empire and war, a dollar a life. Oh, Robert Kennedy, in the time torrent tossed, oh, Robert Kennedy, by the ice machine lost, alone we weep, alone we mourn, alone, as Jean-Paul Sartre once said, with no excuses. Robert Kennedy, he fell down. He fell down by the ice machine. By the ice machine, with the rosary in his hand, he lay by the ice machine. By the ice machine.
Again, Ed Sanders on Poet Radio, WGXC. To conclude the program this evening, I'll be playing documentation of a December 2019 reading that occurred at the Mothership Gallery in Woodstock on the occasion of the opening of an exhibition of Ed Sanders' glyphs. Here we hear him talking about the glyphs, reading poems about the glyphs, and other, and onward.
Thank you for coming to the Glyph Show. There are approximately 200 of glyphs on the walls for different glyphs themes. I do. I work on them just about every day in the morning. There are Egyptian glyphs. I'm attracted to Sappho, so I have Sappho glyphs. I used to study Egyptian language at the New School, and I have a lot of Egyptian. I have all my friends who have passed away, Jonas Mikas, Shirley Schneemann, Uwe Kupferberg, Allen Ginsberg, Ted Bergen. I have a theme of missing my departed friends. My band, The Thugs, exorcised the White House a couple of years ago, so I have a bunch of glyphs I designed getting ready for that exorcism. And I have social responsibility, you know, national health care type glyphs. And then I had a bookstore called the PSI Bookstore in the 60s, so I have some PSI glyphs. So I'm grateful to Paul McMahon for sponsoring this show, because it was a lot of work pulling them out of their boxes and bringing them here and attaching them to the wall. So I'll read three poems. Hymn to Glyphs. What is a glyph? A glyph has the power to shape the spirit. It emblazons shapes, lines, colors, space, and words into an intense zone of enhanced visualization. A glyph can stand out, or it can blend in almost as a word into the text. Many of my glyphs are arrayed with words, but some of them stand by themselves as visual poems. So a glyph can be observed very quickly or be an object of quiet study for an extended time. colored glyphs can be keyed to associate with emotional states. Glyphs in the future will be able to move and change colors. I began putting glyphs into my poetry early in my career. I found that often while writing, I began making drawings on the page of text on which I was working as I paused to reflect and to think. Throughout my writing life, I have drawn glyphs in various investigative poetry projects, in the writings of histories in verse, such as Chekhov, a biography in verse, the poetry and life of Allen Ginsberg, 1968, a history in verse, and the nine-volume America, a history in verse. And now, for several years, I have created a sequence of books combining glyphs and text. One traces the life of Charles Olson. I brought an example of my glyphic history of Charles Olson. Shapes have power to shape the spirit, and the bard can draw those forms for use in the flow of vowels and consonants. A glyph can tremble the brain or even help bring alive the structures of gnosis. The promise of a new living hieroglyphic is of similar order as when the ghost of William Blake's brother gave him the idea for a reverse copper etching for the Songs of Experience. Faces and visual determinatives, as in the ancient Egyptian, can come to verse, a glyph instead of a name in a story poem, or totems for towns in lieu of the letters. All my bardic life, I have drawn them. It began in 1961 when I was in jail studying Egyptian after trying to board a Polaris submarine in a peace demonstration, when I made flashcards in my cell to learn the ancient Egyptian. And then for the next 45 years, I drew glyphs all the time, wherever I was, on planes, in discussions, at political meetings, everywhere, in quick, instant flows of my many pens. Oh, glyphs, please enter my visual pathways and form yourself into my spirit. Oh, glyph of the ancients, who sought to feel a sacred shape, please enter my skin, my heart, the soft strip where visual artifacts form. Oh, glyphs, commingle with my pen and come up with the shapes and forms that Plato described and Matisse cut with his scissors. All hail the glyph.
I'd like to remind people that they are in tune to WGXC in Accra, 90.7 FM. And also that we are in the midst of our fall pledge drive, where we are trying to get sustaining supporters for the station. So please be sure to head over to WGXC.org/donate and help us out if you can.
I was on the William Buckley Show with Jack Kerouac on public television in early September of 1968. It was a memorable event, appearing with Jack Kerouac on the Buckley Show. And hundreds of thousands have, in recent years, watched it on the internet. Jack was driven from Lowell, Massachusetts to New York City for the Buckley Show by his two brothers-in-law, who not long thereafter drove Jack to Gloucester, Massachusetts to pay a visit to the great bard Charles Olson. Olson and Kerouac. In October 1968, there was a surprise visit from Jack Kerouac, who showed up at 28 Ford Square in Gloucester in a black limousine from Lowell, driven by his brothers-in-law.
Jack stood at the back steps of 28 Fort Square, shouting up to Olson's second floor apartment, "Olson, the red carpet, please! Get out the red carpet!" Not having any carpet, Olson placed pages of the Sunday paper on each step leading down the stairs. According to Olson's friend, Charles Bower, to whom Olson described Kerouac's visit, quote, "Kerouac was pleased at the gesture, especially when he found, going up the stairs, that one of the pages he was walking on contained an article on him with his picture." Then a year later, October 21st, 1969, Jack was watching the Galloping Gourmet television show in the morning, making notes in a pad and eating some tuna from a can, when the blood from a burst vein bubbled in his throat and he passed from Earth. It was the second anniversary of the Fugs' exorcism of the Pentagon. That same day, in October of 1969, Allen Ginsberg was just about to leave for a poetry tour, beginning with Yale, then a teach-in about Vietnam at Columbia University. He was at his farm in Cherry Valley. Gregory Corso had come for a visit. That evening, the phone rang. Gregory answered. It was the writer, Al Aronowitz. Gregory turned to Alan. "Al, Jack died." Early the next morning, Ginsberg and Corso walked through the early snow to the woods up the hill and carved Jack's name into a tree. In his book, Charles Olson in Connecticut, Charles Bower writes about the time that Olson learned of the passing of Jack. Bower recalled that Olson was, quote, "startled that he had died so young," unquote. Olson thought about going to the funeral, but couldn't determine whether he'd be buried in Massachusetts or Florida. He told Bower about Kerouac showing up at 28 Fort Square on a Sunday, shouting up to the second floor apartment, "Olson, the red carpet, please! Get out the red carpet!" At which exhortation, Olson placed pages of the Sunday paper on each step leading down the stairs, and one Kerouac stepped upon with an article about him and his photo, too. As for Olson, a few days later, he went into a hospital, soon to be diagnosed with his fatal liver cancer voyage. Mm-hmm. And the final poem I'll read is, I couldn't have done the thousands of glyphs that exist in my archive and in archival boxes without my loving partner of 60 years, Miriam. We met in Greek class at NYU in 1958. I took Greek because my mother told me that a gentleman knows Greek and Latin. So I decided to. And that first day I met a gorgeous blonde woman. Anyway, so a few years ago, it was before the tick nightmare, but a few years ago, Miriam, on a summer night, she was in her loose peach gown beneath the nearly full moon at midnight. She asked me to waltz barefoot on the lawn and do the polka, then lock hands and twirl till the summer stars were streaks. I owe her many things, among them a fresh lesson on the power of Homo Ludens. Homo Ludens is a means partying human. I owe her many things, among them a fresh lesson on the power of Homo Ludens. It's a Jungian phrase, but she was in her loose peach gown, neath the nearly full moon, at midnight, she asked me to waltz barefoot on the lawn and do the polka, then lock hands and twirl till the summer stars were streaks. I owe her many things, among them a fresh lesson on the power of Homo Ludens. Homo Ludens. Thank you.
Ed Sanders on WGXC. Thank you for tuning in. Hope you've enjoyed the program. It has been an enormous pleasure to play these recordings from my collection. I wanted to thank Ed Sanders for the years of inspiration. And Ed is aware that the program is happening, and he wanted me to say that the Glyph 2019 recording should list him as the owner of the copyright. I presume Ed is the owner of the copyright to the other materials, at least most of the other materials as well, so be advised of that. I am. And please consider becoming a sustaining supporter of WGXC. Head on over to wgxc.org/donate. See you next month.